disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, January 30th, 2018. In this episode, we have several interviews. The first is with somebody from Oakland, IWOC, who discusses the recent successful hunger strike and call-in campaigns at Corcoran Prison, located in the Central Valley of California. In a recent update, IWOC on Twitter wrote, quote, "On Monday, January 28th, day 20 of the hunger strike in Corcoran, the warning came to the negotiating table. As a result, two of the demands have been met and the hunger strike has been suspended. Strikers are now getting packages, full canteen privileges, and are negotiating a yard schedule. Negotiations to end the lockdown and restore visitation are yet to come. Stay tuned. Direct action gets the goods." Next up, we talk with members of the Richmond Industrial Workers of the World about recent actions by teachers in Virginia that are part of the growing wave of education strikes across the United States. For our last interview, we talk with some folks from Run a Black Women's Self-Defense Front, who were on the ground in Boston when people came together to kick out neo-Nazis from disrupting the Women's March. Last week, we conclude with a discussion that touches on the recent back-and-forth debate on workplace organizing, as well as critically analyze the difference in Trump's proposal for a wall alongside the Democrats' so-called smart wall. All of this and more, but first, let's get to the news. The strike in Matamoros, Mexico, continues as workers in Detroit are planning a solidarity rally with them, thus linking the struggles together. As the anarchist communism group wrote, quote, "In the U.S., workers are organizing to support the strike in Mexico and against the shutdown of their own plants, with plans for a demonstration in Detroit on February 9th. This shows that workers can realize that they have the same class interests despite borders and talk of a wall. While union leaders spout about forfeiting wage rises and bonuses to save jobs, Matamoros workers marched to the border crossing between their city and Brownsville, Texas, just over the border, in a bid to win the solidarity of U.S. workers. In the face of drastic cold in Chicago, groups like Little Village Solidarity Network, the General Defense Committee, and the Libertarian Socialist Caucus are gathering warming supplies and distributing them throughout the city. So far, they have raised over $4,000, and every dollar donated will go to help people directly impacted by the cold front. You can PayPal them, linked in our show notes. In West Virginia, a teacher strike may again be back on, as teachers in Mingo County have just cast a strike vote, which is expected to pass. In Columbus, Ohio, people vandalize new parking meters in the downtown, allowing free parking until they are fixed. Proud Boys and Warriors for Christ were run off from a Detroit area library. The far-right goon showed up to protest drag queens reading stories to kids. People mobilized in response. In Portland, people held an anti-ICE rally. In Portland, Oregon, and in Brooklyn, New York, anti-fascist music festivals went off without a hitch, and despite threats from Patriot Prayer in Portland, people did not see any uninvited guests. The Inland Empire chapter of the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement participated in the drop-off of fresh water and supplies at the border for crossing migrants. In Chicago, people made quick work of neo-Nazi flyers, and members of Tank in Oakland were out in force organizing around public housing. If you are a power-hungry proletarian and want to get involved in the Bay Area of California, check them out and see the awesome work that they are doing. An anti-ICE demonstration took place in Bristol County. In Los Angeles, people at the LA Tenants Union are occupying an apartment in order to stop the sheriff from evicting a family. In Gainesville, Florida, the local IWOC chapter is celebrating after more contracts for prison slave labor have been going up in smoke. Tensions remain high at the Unistone camp, with Native people denouncing the actions of the RCMP and resource extraction companies. Check out our recent updates and statements on IGD from the Unistone camp, as well as video dispatches from Submedia. That's going to do it for us today. Enjoy the interviews, and as always, we will see you next time.
With the Oakland chapter, and we've been on point with the local Corcoran hunger strike.
So just real quick, for those that don't know, where is Corcoran in relation to the so-called United States, and is it a large facility?
Corcoran is huge. Corcoran is a collection of 5 facilities, like a whole complex. It's in the Central Valley and basically south of the Bay Area. You know, basically go down to about Salinas and then hop over into the Central Valley, you know, a bit east, and that's where it's at. And the hunger strike was in their maximum security facility, like a level 4 called 3C, which has approximately like 5 units of 200 people each, so almost like 1,100 people in that unit itself, and sometimes it's referred to as Old Corcoran.
And when did this begin?
Well, the recent events began in September 28th. Mm-hmm. 3 members of the Sureños, like Southern Mexicans, like street organization, went to the infirmary being stabbed. All the Southerners were attacked by this rogue prisoner formation and like a street group called Fresno Bulldogs. And the Bulldogs are basically non-signatories to the agreement to end hostilities here in California, which is a truce between all the major population segments and, you know, racial groups. Fresno Bulldogs have basically made all their power and influence inside off of being a spoiler, off of essentially breaking up agreements and breaking solidarity with the other prisoners. And they basically went on full attack mode and attacked the Southerners. Then the whole facility went on lockdown, or what CDCR calls a modified program, which is a lockdown in everything but name. And the Southerners, which are the object of this attack, basically the targets, were locked down now for like almost 4 months. And come January 9th, they decided they could do no more with it. And their segment basically engaged in a hunger strike. And CDCR has confirmed that the hunger strike peaked at about 270 individuals refusing all meals. There's a 9-meal threshold. Like, once you refuse 9 meals, they count you as being on hunger strike. And they spent 20 days until yesterday when the hunger strike was suspended.
And they've actually they've won in some capacity, right?
Absolutely. Like, this is a big win. Word was eventually sent out and asked for the hunger strike to be made public. Word got to us. We were able to confirm what was going on by multiple sources and started publicizing a phone action and publicized their demands. And that unleashed a massive wave of support and pressure, with families going deep and hard on CDCR. Like, there's a comment section on the webpage where we publicize this, it's like 50 comments deep. Mm-hmm. With family that had been scared for 3 months, 4 months, unwilling to say anything because knowing that CDCR watching could easily come back at their loved ones inside and throw them into solitary or do God knows what, including like set them up for dogfights, gladiator matches on the exercise yard, which is basically used as a form of summary punishment and an additional tool of CDCR basically to divide prison populations and create what they called a bad environment. But yesterday, basically with the massive wave of support and basically strikers, families, and outside solidarity workers like IWOC, like, formed a mighty force, and calls to the warden's boss, to internal affairs, reporting the guard misconduct and how they're setting up fights, to Sacramento, to the warden's office. And basically some media interest started coming loose because they started getting calls from, you know, national publications. The warden came to the negotiating table, and 2 of their demands have already been met. Like, now they're all getting canteen again. They can buy stuff from commissary, and they can receive packages, and they're negotiating yard time to be separated from this rogue group so that violence doesn't occur anymore. So 2 of the major demands have already been met. So I wouldn't call it an end to the hunger strike. It's basically been suspended while negotiations, you know, continue, and they basically work out or continue to press for visitation and an end to the lockdown, and to basically resume all their education, rehab, and religious programming that's been denied them for 4 months.
Awesome, yeah, and we encourage people to check out incarceratedworkers.org and see all those comments. I mean, it's pretty amazing just the amount of of interaction with family members and people on the outside people have with the IWOC page and the comments they leave. But anything else you want to say, definitely check out the website for updates on more on this developing story.
Yeah, well, some family members are planning a peaceful demonstration outside Corcoran on the 9th and 10th during visiting hours. And there's also activities in Sacramento heating up against reintegration, which is another effort of CDCR to basically instigate violence and cause division in the prisoner population by basically putting protected custody in SNY or sensitive needs yard. People that have been separated, like throwing them back and forcing them back into the main population and then starting a bunch of fights, which basically opens a pipeline up to the SHU. So there'll be a demonstration in Sacramento on the 15th as well. But yeah, check out IWOC on Twitter. And check out incarceratedworkers.org and get involved. And at least just to read the comments on the Corcoran Phones app page. It's like 60 comments long, and it sounds like some CDCR employee wandered into the comments section and basically gets lit up by families not taking any of that as crap.
Hey, thanks so much for talking with us.
Right on.
I'm Lenny from among other things, the Richmond IWW. And I'm Dylan. Also from the Richmond IWW.
So what happened the other day? You know, another set of teachers have now entered into kind of the fray. What's going on in Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, similar to a lot of different places in the country, but I would probably compare it most similarly to West Virginia. Teachers in Virginia have seen a really intense stagnation in a lot of stuff, but like wages, and then just funding for infrastructure in school and for like just very much day-to-day things. So I think the Red for Ed movement's, you know, been picking up in a number of places. And in Virginia, there's been a lot of people saw what's happening in LA and West Virginia. And so there were folks doing similar stuff across the state here. And this is kind of one of the first big demonstrations. I think Dylan can probably fill you a little more on that history. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's no question that the strike wave that we could trace back to the Chicago teacher strike and then through to the West Virginia strike and then more recently to Los Angeles and Oakland. But there's no question that that's the situation that made possible Virginia Educators United and the Red for Ed action the other day.
Awesome. Well, you just want to just talk about it. A lot of people have seen the photos. There was a lot of IWW flags out there. I'm just kind of curious, kind of like what all went down that day, and also how did the IWW participate as a group as well?
Yeah, I mean, so our branch, sort of even before this is really picking up steam, we've just had a pretty high ratio of educators from a number of fields in there. We've got teachers, we've got some librarians, we've also got some folks who work with like adult education, special needs, things like that. And so I think there was kind of just already a little bit of an awareness of it among like members of the branch that it was coming. Yeah, Dylan did a lot of work with teachers who are trying to organize, in particular, trying to like do a little bit more of a vocal or like, I guess, militant, for lack of a better word, demonstration compared to sort of the very tame demonstration that I think like the Virginia Secretary of Education was expecting. And I think as with, you know, any class struggle, there's going to be forces from the ruling class and their allies that are going to attempt to divert the struggle away from class self-organization and self-activity. And those tensions definitely manifested themselves the day of, specifically with the earlier rally at which, you know, Democratic Party politicians spoke and sort of business union representatives spoke, whereas in contrast, the bulk of the rally was rank-and-file teachers, you know, bus drivers, teaching assistants, administrators, a lot of different sectors of the education workforce that were mobilized and showed a very high level of self-organization from organizing their own transportation through cooperation with, you know, the bus drivers and all these different sort of sectors of the education workforce coming together in a really, you know, militant and disciplined way. And I think that those are the two tensions between Balatana's class organization and the forces that were trying to divert it towards more and then we've been seeing that discrepancy might develop a little bit, and so like some of the local labs and labs around the state, and then mostly like Dylan's saying, like mostly just teachers working on their own out of frustration. Really, the reason that the rally was as big as it was and as organized as it was, had so many resources, really came down to, I think, similar to West Virginia, there was just a lot of fairly decentralized organizing going on by rank and file school employees. And so we sort of put in contact with some of the folks who were pushing for that stuff and were helping out because, you know, we're familiar with Richmond. So, I mean, some of the branch members were just doing stuff like helping with getting the buses where they needed to go this morning or that morning. And then, you know, there had been a permit gotten for the event. So there was the expectation from the Richmond police that this entire crowd of several thousand people was going to march down a single bike lane, which basically resulted in a crowd that was maybe like 5 abreast and extremely claustrophobic marching. So blobs and then just a bunch of local radical folks and like angry teachers who were claustrophobic ended up wanting to take the whole street. So that led to some tensions during the march itself. They kind of wanted us to march, you know, in this like sort of parade route with probably 3 cops every half block all the way down to the Capitol from Monroe Park on VCU campus. And what ended up happening was, as the march went on, a lot of people started breaking out and trying to take the whole street. And so there was mostly just a lot of yelling, siren moving, police cars being driven quickly up behind old teachers who were just not trying to walk in a tight crowd. We were trying to, a lot of us have a lot of familiarity with street demos in Richmond, so we were trying to just do a combination of encourage, you know, that beautiful act of taking the street and also make sure nobody got stabbed or hit. And as for the photos of all the flags, I mean, we all have a lot of flags, and this is the first time we were okay, we actually want to take those out and wave them because it's a windy day and it'll look nice and everybody's wearing red. So
What advice would you give for anybody that's living in an area where a teacher strike is about to pop off? What can they tangibly do if they're not, you know, if they don't work as a teacher in the education sector? How can they actually participate in material support?
I think there's a lot of avenues that one could take. One thing that was really important in the build-up with Red for Ed was building linkages with community members, with parents, and with students, because one of the ruling class narratives around teacher strikes, especially when questions of pay and funding are involved, is that teachers are greedy, or that they're just out, you know, to get more money. They want to take away public money for themselves, and then these kind of capitalist narratives that get turned against the teacher's class struggle. So what you're seeing, and you saw this in West Virginia, you saw this in LA, and you saw this in Richmond, was that these are community labor struggles. There's a whole, that are on the, you know, terrain of social reproduction that encompass a lot of different aspects of everyday life. So I think one way people can get involved is building community support, reaching out to parents, reaching out to students, and just building that, you know, that base of popular support among different sectors, because this, you know, the struggle in education is about so much more than just, you know, things like teachers' pay or the physical structures within which education takes place. This is also an opportunity to have conversations about, what is the function of education in our society? What types of educational forms do we even want if we had that type of power from below to decide that? Yeah, I think exactly that. And then also I think it's really important to stress that one of the things that we were very pleasantly surprised by, and I think a lot of people were with this demonstration, was like Dylan mentioned earlier, this is being, you know, presented in the news as a teacher walkout, but that crowd was, you know, there's a lot of rank and file teachers in there, but there was also just a lot of people from the entire, you know, education infrastructure that exists. There was a lot of bus drivers, there were service workers, there were people who were fed up trying to repair broken stuff. I mean, there was even a local carpenters union out there. And so just recognizing what is your personal link to teachers in your family or your community, and also like people who are involved in school, and that includes students, and going to them and asking them, like, hey, what can I do to support you if you wanted to stick your head up a little bit about this? I think, you know, one of the big things that they really needed was, like, you know, they really need childcare. It's an entire crowd of people who are around children a lot. What they really needed was transport to the event. A lot of folks couldn't drive, so there's a lot of school buses and church buses that were used, water, things like that. Just like stuff that people who are familiar with organizing street actions could offer folks who are just getting involved with that.
Well, anything you want to add on this topic?
Two things quickly that we were talking about before you called. We're really interested in the way that in LA, there's been a really heavy involvement of students, and the students have really pushed the strikes there, you know, in a more radical direction. A good friend of mine who recently, like, started talking about this and really turned me on to that idea. So I think, like, thinking about, like, you know, kids are smart, they recognize what's up, and, like, seeing what they might want to do is a good move. And then the other thing I will say, you know, this was a very liberal demonstration ultimately, but even so, we had a state senator tweet a picture from inside the General Assembly of the crowd claiming socialists infiltrated it, and we had a number of, like, right-wing doxing, like pseudo-faux journalists of the history kind of dox people showing up and just taking pictures of, like, very unsuspecting teachers, you know, trying to interview them and stuff. So, like, just watching out for, like, InfoWars types, bash, things like that, and, like, just, you know, I think a lot of people really are naive about how good the infrastructure of the right is to events like this, and so that's something that we are aware of, and it's good to be able to offer that. I know we definitely were able to offer that in regards to, like, police escalation the other day.
And so my closing thought would be that for all the revolutionaries out there, that for all of us who want to, you know, overthrow and abolish the capitalist system and to rebuild workers' power, you know, this is a real important moment right now, with the strike wave centering around education. And I think that it's, you know, not without coincidence that it's in educational institutions that you have all these different sectors of communities and students and workers, from teachers to, you know, janitors to bus drivers, coming together in that, you know, for all of us who believe in the autonomous self-organization of the working class, this is like a chance for us to push and to refill our infrastructure and to hold the line and to hopefully just keep on pushing until we break through this thing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Okay, we are joined here today with two people out of the Boston and Providence area with the group Red and Black Women's Self-Defense Front. We're going to be talking about what all went down and what happened in the Boston area. The Lovable Cretins from Resist Marxism, which is a front group of several white nationalist groups and far-right organizations, came to Boston once again because apparently they just love to lose. Why did they come back? Why do they keep coming back to there?
They basically just get their rocks off from being trolls at this point.
Yeah, honestly, it does sort of feel like they love getting fed down. It's become formulaic at this point, like, how these actions get structured, right? Like, they show up, they start to yell a little bit, and then it almost immediately gets shut down and they get, like, escorted out.
Yeah, I mean, this is a conversation that some people are having, is just, you know, it's these groups are very small at this point. You know, what are they getting out of this? Their rhetoric seems to be increasingly violent in Portland. I don't know if it's the same situation in Boston. In Boston, it just seems like they just keep trying to get to a certain point and they just can't get there.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Resist Marxism in Boston, well, this time around, pretty much everyone who they brought out for this event was kind of like a bruiser type of person. So, like, the leader of Resist Marxism is this guy, Chris Bartley. He just came back from a lengthy stay in Florida after getting run out of town, essentially. Yeah, and, like, along with him came a few members of the American Guard, like John Camden, Boston's lone fourth degree proud boy, Ken Lizardo, who goes on Facebook as Rad Lizardo. These two masked up people who are kind of like in this with 3% patches on, but were kind of like doing like a Soldiers of Odin type of look too.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like I don't want to like dismiss the fact that they are for the most part like just a bunch of weird, goofy trolls who are like going through a bunch of internal like fractures of their own, but like they are still like a militant reactionary movement, and like we make fun of them, but we do still have to, I think, like take them seriously as a movement.
Right. Yeah, very much so. Well, on that note, let's talk about what all happened. They had planned to rally kind of before the Women's March had started. You know, they made a video, which was very bizarre, and they put up kind of a Facebook event. So, I mean, they definitely wanted people to come out. Can you just talk all, you know, what happened? They showed up and then people surrounded them. What all went down?
The short version is they showed up, people circled around them, but we didn't really have the numbers to like, do much other than like circle around them and sort of shout them down before the police showed up. And then after that, it just sort of got like the same sort of formulaic action that it has been, at least for us, and I'm sure in like other cities where they're surrounded by cops, we're outside of the kettle, we yell at them, they yell at us. That sort of went down for a little while before like the actual sort of Women's March started. They were able to get far closer to the stage than I think anyone really wanted them to, which was unfortunate, and I think something that shouldn't continue to be allowed to happen, but they got protected by cops and like weirdly platformed by some of the like speakers that the Women's March had like arranged to come out there. Like they're engaging with them in a way that I think was really stupid. But
yeah, there was like this one speaker who was like, everyone in front of the stage on the grass is loved, and like it's strange liberal ideological nonsense.
Well, I was just going to ask, I think that's the other kind of question that that these type of events kind of bring up. It's like, you know, we obviously have a lot of things to say about the Women's March itself. I mean, you know, all its internal politics, just the way it's structured. You know, so people are going out to, you know, defend this space. And I don't know, it's an interesting, you know, conversation to have. It's like we're, you know, actively putting ourselves on the line to like defend the space that we also have, you know, some like really valid critiques of.
I will say, I think in this context, like these folks kind of fucked themselves over. A lot of them being who they are, like rolled with a bunch of like vote for Trump, like Trump 2020 year, whatever, like their MAGA hats. And yeah, just because of the, oh, sorry.
I was just gonna say, like there was one person in like a Trump 42 Patriots jersey. Like
in the context of the Women's March, that was a really, I think, intentional but also bad move for them, because it made a lot of like liberals that probably would have otherwise been like even the slightest bit sympathetic to them on like free speech or like whatever reactionary anti-communist grounds that they have, instead like really hostile towards them in a way that benefited folks on the left. So
do y'all feel that that being out there and kind of being like I don't know, a buffer force, or just people that are willing to put themselves in between. Did that like create any sort of conversations with other people or help build relationships? I mean, do you feel like there's something like very positive that comes out of like engaging in that certain way?
Yeah, we were actually very successful with flyers and zines. Pro tip, it turns out if you have a flyer printed in color, liberals will just sort of accept you being there. It worked great. It had the names and faces of a lot of the people we had expected to show up, just in like a brief explanation of who we were. It worked very well, I'd say. Like, there were a lot of like random older women who like were nervous and apprehensive until they got handed a flyer, and then were like vaguely supportive.
Did people from the Women's March like end up like taking part in like
pushing back against the Nazis? Like, did they see them there and then kind of like switch over to the other activity, or were people kind of like staying with the Women's March?
Yeah. So what happened towards the end of the Women's March was that, so the Women's March actually did a little bit of marching, like three blocks around. As they were exiting the commons, the police, who had been kettling the fash for about 5 hours at this point, started to move them off the commons. We were giving chase. Some random liberals from the Women's March actually wrapped scarves around their faces and joined up with us. We chased fascists around and were being pushed by police. Boston police, by the way, were being incredibly aggressive towards women at the Women's March, I'd like to point out.
Yeah, that was, I think, a really weird element of this, was like the degree to which, because, I mean, like, at least historically in actions here, like, there's been a, like, weird, with certain exceptions, like, weird neutrality between, like, BPD and, like, anti-fash, where, like, they'll largely either just, like, threaten to mass arrest or, like, mass arrest, but for the most part, again, with limited exceptions, they haven't, like, really engaged in a directly hostile way with folks who are, like, locked up or who are engaging in anti-fascist work. But, like, this was a really, really radically different experience for a lot of us, where they were, like, very aggressive and very, like, I don't know. It seemed like they were about as exhausted with the, like, I think, back and forth dance that is how these actions have historically gone for us as we all were. I don't really know how else to describe it, but yeah, watching cops get really, really physically aggressive with women at the Women's March was a, I think, definitely at least like a semi-radicalizing experience for a lot of the like normies and like liberals who ended up sort of engaging in the anti-fascist work.
At some point, they just like loaded them onto a paddy wagon and then got them out of there, right?
Yeah, that was at a point where they'd been sort of, at that point, trying to kettle us. We ran around the block to sort of try and cut them off. And, you know, sort of blockaded a street slightly. And at that point, I guess, BPD just gave up, loaded them up in the paddy wagon, and then gave them a nice escort to their cars on their way mostly back to New Hampshire.
Actually, I mean, Boston police like took them to a train station didn't let women from the Women's March onto the train station. Instead, like, cordoned it off so that the fash had an escape route. Surreal.
Wow.
It's also like the first time they've just loaded them into paddy wagons and drove them out. This is like a real consistent thing for Boston. And I think it's just like a question of the sort of degree of police presence and police militarization here versus like other cities, I think.
Yeah. Like, one of sort of like the notable details about Boston police is that like they train in Israel with IDF. They're like the only police department in the state that doesn't train at state facilities.
Yeah, there are several police departments that do that actively across the U.S. that get some training from Israeli Defense Forces. Well, anything else that you want to bring up or that came up for you during this engagement? Any other lessons or anything else you want to talk about?
Not really. You know, I think, like, the big thing for us, and this has, like, been an internal conversation that we've been having, I think also a large external conversation that's been taking place, like, in the organizing scene, is, like, what it means to sort of do anti-fascist work when, like, I don't know, like, in the context of increasing police militarization, where, like, the sort of, like, traditional work or the work that's, like, done in Europe or in the Midwest is, like, more difficult in places like Boston, where we have so many police so ready to, like, use really militant tactics against us, is like, how do we mobilize a broader base? And so, like, it was really, I think, successful for us to, like, have a sort of semi-outward-facing organizational name, like the one that you have for us, the Renton Black Women's Self-Defense Front, and, like, having zines and flyers and shit. Like, it allowed us to, like, engage with otherwise, like, apolitical or liberal folks in a, like, really productive way. And I think this is, like, one of the sort of more productive actions for us, at least in that regard.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, just allowing people, giving them information, encouraging them to get involved. Because, you know, regardless of their low numbers, we are seeing escalations in a lot of places. I mean, we're seeing it in the Pacific Northwest with Joy Gibson and his friends, but also we've seen it with, you know, Patriot Front. They've been out at two pro-life marches the past couple weeks. They were out in Chicago and they were out in D.C. They were actually handing out flyers to those MAGA kids that, you know, were later filmed harassing, you know, indigenous people at the mall in D.C. So, I mean, they're stepping out of their kind of, you know, comfort zones and trying to come out more into the open. And, you know, they're not going away. I mean, Identity Europa and Patriot Front are still putting up just as many posters as they ever were.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it's something that's been, once again, very well documented. Like, the sort of, I guess you can call them the alt-light aspects of the reactionary movement have been receding, and like what we're left is or left with is the much more like reactionary, more explicitly fascist organizations like Patriot Front and Identity Europa. And like, yeah, like they're just dropping all pretenses of like caring about like, oh, free speech, you know, like Patriot Prayer in Portland showed up to the IWW hall to shut down a DSA meeting. Like,
right. Just a couple nights ago, they vandalized it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I think the idea that things are like slowing down or cooling off is not true. I think that it's just as hot as it was, you know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they have as much of a mass base, but the people who are involved are much more willing to be violent.
Right.
I mean, even that, I think, is not, I don't know, like, it seems like in the Midwest and in sort of outside of, like, the sort of metropolitan centers, like, they are still building a mass base. It's, like, we don't see it as much here, but, like, we've definitely been in conversation with folks who are, like, watching them build movements on the ground in like really, really horrifying ways. And it's something I think that we need to start like actively countering by mobilizing a sort of broader base ourselves.
Yeah, it's not just enough to like show up and be opposition. You have to be building, like, be actively building a counter movement.
Strike in 1946, there was something passed called the Taft-Hartley Law, which outlawed what the state referred to as solidarity strike. So basically, it outlawed, you know, general strike. So if you know, little Timmy on the street is unfortunately shot by the pigs, and then, you know, the union that he works for goes on strike, and then my union where I work says, like, yes, this is egregious, we too will go on strike in solidarity. Or, you know, workers across an industry that are part of a supply chain, like we were talking about earlier, decide to go on strike for common interest. That could be ruled illegal under the Taft-Hartley law. And, you know, it obviously has scared a lot of unions who are locked in this kind of legalese. You know, we don't fight in the streets. We fight, you know, back in the boardrooms with lawyers. And it's not about, you know, refusing our labor. It's about this, like, legalistic dance with capital and so on and so forth.
Well, which has its roots in the AFL and the construction of the American Federation of Labor as an alternative to the CIO, which was run by the Communist Party, and the IWW. Mm-hmm. The AFL, the purpose of the AFL, was to essentially make labor a loyal opposition.
Right.
The Taft-Hartley Act was about codifying that law. That's why I said earlier, I think what's going to get really interesting here, what's going to get most interesting in the United States, because there's not a contemporary history of this after the early 1970s, where in the early 70s you did see wildcat strikes at, ironically, the Lordstown car factory, GM factory. There was a wildcat strike, a pretty famous one. There were more wildcat strikes in Detroit, specifically in the auto industry. But those were workers acting on their own without the union. And I think what's going to get really fascinating here is how long it's going to take before workers in unions start to act without either the tacit approval of or in any discourse with their formal labor unions.
Oh, of course. And that's why the teacher strikes are so important, is not because they're just like a lot of people on strike. You know, it's not like the women's march, you know, in terms of labor. It's just like a lot of people out in the street. Ooh, it's a lot of people basically giving the middle finger to the establishment, both in terms of the union leadership, but more importantly, the democratic leaders that work hand in glove with union bureaucrats to basically tell the workers, you know, look, this is how much we're going to cut. This is how, you know, this is the small amount of raises you're going to get. You're going to give up this in terms of health care and other benefits. And the teacher strikes basically were a refusal of that in a mass way. And people got, you know, they got more than they would have gotten if they would have gone the other way, which is, you know, the real message. And I think, you know, it remains to be seen how far that can go. And also, too, just, you know, for activists that are within unions, I mean, if you spent any time in a big city, or if you've ever been at a place where there's a labor union, I mean, you realize when you're in there that, you know, there are people with, like, really crappy reactionary politics. You know, yeah. There are people that actually have pretty good, you know, politics, that actually want labor unions to be part of wider social movements and actually, you know, are at their baseline, at least anti-capitalist and so on and so forth. But it's a mix, and it's a lot of times within these organizations, it's a battle.
Well, and if we look at the roots of the labor movement, especially in areas of the country that are really heavy in organized labor, specifically Rust Belt towns, where, I mean, you still, in a lot of Rust Belt cities, have 20% labor, organized labor concentration. The union's gospel in places like that, you get brought up with that, almost as a religion, and whether or not your family is union itself, because the way that the labor movement existed in places like that, and still does to a degree, is that it's very social. It's not limited to the workplace. That when people go on strike, restaurants offer free food, people offer free childcare. You know, there's all of these different people that step up and help allow the strike to continue. You know, truck drivers refuse to deliver or pick up at those factories. You know, they actually shut the factory down through just refusing to circulate the goods. These kinds of things are what built a lot of those cities, not because of good wages, right, which is what the Democrats like to talk about. They like to talk about how good union wages built these strong middle classes in all of these Rust Belt cities. And there's definitely a part of that, but it's more about a mentality and a politics around the idea of having control over your workplace, having the ability to collectively decide stuff, that even with reactionary politics aside from that, those things are almost taken as preconditions in a lot of places for a lot of people. And even if you ask a lot of conservatives in the labor movement, places like that, the reason they're conservative comes back to similar values, which is really interesting, right? And so one of the things that we've lost in the idea of organized labor, and I'm personally in no way like a workerist, but one of the things that we've lost in this concept is specifically that organized labor has become workerist. Namely, it's become centered around the workplace and the industry, not around the community and the city.
They're like labor brokerage firms. That's how most unions are, you know.
That's essentially what they are, yeah. Especially
and that's how most people actually, I mean, I went down to the union hall and that, you know, they told me this is where I'm going to go today as an electrician. I mean,
absolutely. Yep. You see that in building trades more than anything. They take you in as an apprentice, they train you, and they give you all your work. That's essentially what it's become. It's become totally recuperated within capitalism. But the core of the labor movement is not that. The core of the labor movement is very radical, is very collective, and very horizontal.
You know, that effect, I had a friend is a member of the IWW. He worked as, let's just say, an electrician, but he was with his friend and they had some sort of issue on the job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what it was, but he was talking to his friend and his friend said, like, well, if we don't get what we want, we're going to go ahead and wobble it. And
yep.
To that sense, he meant that they were going to sabotage something on the job site in order to get what they want. I don't know the exact details, but it doesn't really matter. And his friend thought this was hilarious because he knew exactly what he meant. But then the guy turned to me and said, he's like, I don't even really know what that means. But he's like, I know what it means, but I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
And I think it really reminds me of when, during the West Virginia teacher strike, there was a point when the governor of West Virginia, who actually he was a Republican, and then at some point then he switched to being a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
To basically win the election, but he's a really reactionary guy. He was going to the Capitol during the early start of the demonstrations, and this is all documented in a lot of the interviews we did with a lot of the teachers during the onset of the strike. If you want to go back and listen to the It's Going Down podcast about this, but he said something to the effect like, all these rednecks at the Capitol, meaning the teachers on strike, are freaking me out. He said, I'm afraid I might get shot.
Mm-hmm.
And in response, people then started to show up with the red bandanas around their necks.
Yep.
And in West Virginia, that had a very real iconography, because it went back to the so-called Redneck War of 1921, when miners essentially, you know, launched an uprising of, you know, over 10,000 working people against several thousand strike breakers and also police, you know, with guns. They rose up, basically took over towns, took over entire areas, you know, launched literally an insurrection against the United States military. The United States military responded all the way up to using the Air Force. It's the only time the Air Force has been used on the American population to put down the insurgency. You know, like people say, you can still find bullets in the hills. And there's actually, if you go to Appalachia, if you go to West Virginia, if you go to Blair Mountain, there's a museum there, and people there are like very, like you were saying, people are very proud of their history.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, we could do a whole tangent on this about also how I think, I don't know if it was here or a different podcast somebody was talking about, or was it us at one point talking about how Appalachia also, you know, resisted a lot of the Confederacy as well. So there's this kind of feeling collectively like, you know, we've resisted all these, like, you know, states essentially. But I just think it's so funny that, you know, like we were saying, we forget so many of these, you know, either these stories or traditions or ways to fight, but very quickly people remember, and that there are these things that are passed down that even if we don't know everything about it, or we're not totally clued in, it's still there just beneath the surface.
Well, and I think, you know, there's something definitely to be said for, people saying that, you know, the character of labor has changed. And that makes traditional labor organizing an invalid strategy. And that may or may not be the case. And labor has changed dramatically, right? I mean, significant amounts of millennials are freelancing, things like that. Very few people have stable work. But the one thing that hasn't changed is that if we withdraw our labor in large numbers, it still causes mass crisis, just inherently, right? Capitalism still thrives on the construction of using labor as wage labor to be able to construct commodities for circulation. And if that gets disrupted, it all falls apart. And so that could happen through financial crisis, right, as we saw in 2008. But that can also happen through people actually taking industrial action. That can happen through computer programmers refusing to update their servers. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that this can things like this can go down. And I don't think that one needs to be a workerist to recognize the strategic potential role of people taking industrial action, right?
No, and I don't think people need to like either believe in this dream that industrial capitalist civilization, you know, we're just going to self-manage it and like as long as the workers run it, it'll all be okay. Or, you know, we just basically want, you know, a cooperative, you know, worker-owned version of this world. And like, no, I don't think that at all. Like, I don't think you have to just because you're engaged in workplace organizing or you see the benefit of you know, class war, you know, where a lot of people spend hours of their day. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very clear. I mean, there's obviously if you've been reading It's Going Down, there's been an ongoing debate about syndicalism and unions. There's actually when we're recording this, there's an article that just went up from like an anarchist position, basically in defense of workplace and union organizing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also interesting, too, because I've heard a lot of people like from the post left or other positions state like, kind of like, well, unions are doesn't really matter because everybody just works through an app or something like that. It's like, well, if you look at the UK right now, they're the IWW and a bunch of other kind of like independent grassroots sort of like autonomous syndicalist unions that are kind of new. They're the ones that are launching strikes against Uber Eats, against yep. Amazon. Like, they're doing all these cool things. Like, look at Europe. Like, they're fucking burning down, like, Amazon trucks and launching, like, big strikes inside. Like, there's some, like, serious shit that's going on there. And definitely anarchist, like, explicitly anarchist syndicalist unions are, like, playing a role. They might not be doing all the things, but they're playing a role.
Well, and as a person who myself very much identifies as being a part of the post left, I think one of the things that people miss in this discussion, which is one I've been following very carefully, you know, the claim always is the form of labor has changed. It's become a sort of technocratic labor. And as that's happened, that's invalidated traditional forms of workerism. And I think that there is a lot to be said for that. However, that doesn't invalidate the sort of production of wage labor as a strategic site of intervention. It's still something that occurs, right?
No.
Just occurs differently. And so as that occurrence shifts and changes in character, it's just as important for us to be tracking the differences in that and how that changes what intervention looks like, and whether or not it's a relevant point of intervention, right? And our calculus around that. It's just as important for us to track that as it is for us to track anything else. To neglect that just because labor has changed and syndicalism has become sort of invalidated in its traditional forms because of that is blindness, really, to the basic reality that most people live every day, which is wake up and they go to work, they come home, they make dinner for their kids, and they like hang out for a couple of hours and watch TV and go to sleep and wake up and do it all over again. And that's a pretty normal life in the United States. And what that means is that it's not as simple as the 8-hour working, 8-hour off, 8-hour sleeping kind of calculus of the 8-hour workday. That in fact, most people now, because they're freelancing, because they're working through apps or because they're working sort of, you know, service industry jobs or white collar jobs, aren't working 8 hours a day. They're working like 10, 12 hours a day. They have no leisure time. Right. What that means is that as the amount of hours that people are working is going up, that makes it an even more crucial site of intervention. Just because purely there's people there, it's something that we do in our everyday life. I think what's ironic about this discussion in the post-left is that a lot of people in the post-left came into the post-left through the Situationist International. Right. I'm one of them. and the kind of shift of focus into the terrain of everyday life. And yet a lot of those same people are so willing to throw out the idea of the workplace as a legitimate site of intervention, even though that in itself is a core part of that everyday life that we constantly are talking about.
Right. And it also presupposes that anarchism today has nothing to offer, you know, like, for instance, I don't know, millennials driving Uber or something like that. Like, that's why it was so interesting. Like, I remember about a year ago, It's Going Down republished an article that came out on the Black Rose Federation website about Indonesian Uber drivers who basically had formed kind of like a hybrid, like, it's like the Black Bloc meets like Uber Union. And it was like, they had like four rules. It was like anarchist. And they asked, like, are you a loser or a hero? And that was one of the things. But they were doing marches and stuff, and they would meet in parks. So it was kind of this like collective, communal, very autonomous kind of bringing people together. And, you know, like that's, I think that's what anarchism has to offer, that. And it's actually produced a vehicle in which all these people that are scattered, you know, that don't have a union hall, that don't even have an office where everybody meets eye to eye in the morning before they go out, you know, to drive their cars. Like, they're just people out on the road, and all they have is like a sticker on their car, maybe, or in Indonesia, it's a lot of people on motorcycles or bikes and stuff like that. So, I mean, to me, I think that's really interesting, and that's incredible. And that's also like people thinking strategically and looking around at their surroundings and then actually coming up with a political strategy that actually physically works, because they have several thousand people that are in their, you know, their formation.
Well, and I think what that shows, and this gets back to kind of this discussion around autonomous action amongst working populations, I think it's totally valid to say that unions have essentially become forces of recuperation, right? Their job is to get better wages and better healthcare and stuff for their workers. They're not revolutionary organizations. They haven't been for a very long time. And that's a totally fair conclusion. However, again, that doesn't validate the workplace as a site of intervention. And what we're seeing in something like Uber drivers going on strike, or what we see when writers go on strike at newspapers or in the movie industry, or what we see when tech workers refuse to work, right? So there's this famous example of Google. Google got caught doing image recognition for U.S. military surveillance systems. I forget the specifics of it. It has something to do with drone targeting. And something like 10% of Google employees threatened to walk off the job, like signed a letter threatening to walk off the job if Google continued. And a few dozen people actually quit their jobs, and it forced Google to back down from the program. Like, that's significant. Google's technology is really good, right? Using that technology to target drone strikes is devastating. And a few Google employees quitting their jobs and a bunch more threatening to walk off the job was enough to get the company to back down from a multi-billion dollar deal. You're seeing a similar thing now with Amazon employees starting to raise questions about how the facial recognition technology that they've made is being used, right? It's like the ACLU just filed a lawsuit today demanding that the Department of Justice reveal whether or not they're using Amazon facial recognition technology in surveillance systems. So far, that story has been more or less pretty confined to the tech industry. But the effectiveness of Amazon's facial recognition technology is almost unparalleled.
Well, that's what I...
That program, that's significant. Significant.
That's what I think is really interesting about kind of these new labor formations, is that essentially they are going back to a pre-New Deal type confederation where they're really underground, you know, private... Well, not private, but like underground, you know, illegalist formations. I mean, like, I think if you look at like a group that's really interesting, like the Tech Workers Coalition, which is very radical, very like horizontal, anti-capitalist, has really good politics. I mean, from my understanding, they're really growing, and they have, you know, a lot of reach in a lot of these expanding tech worker struggles. But I mean, they're not like signing up people for, you know, like a formal membership, to my understanding. And also, it's not like their goal is not to like win union, like labor board elections. It's to like create an association, and they have meetings and stuff like that. So it's formal in the sense it's like in real life, face to face, people meeting and getting mm-hmm. organized. But it's not like a formal organization in the sense, from my understanding, where you know, you're like voting for an election that's then recognized by the state.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, like if you look at something like Burgerville, I mean, they essentially have the same model, even though they're doing elections and they're getting recognized. I mean, they're still spreading out their membership to all these stores, which is really incredible. I mean, they have like 3 stores now that are like officially part of the union. But I mean, they have all these different programs, like people help watch each other's kids. Mm-hmm. They have food and stuff that they share. They have like podcasts. They have like, you know, support in different ways. I mean, I think it's really cool, and it's yeah. awesome to see all these different experiments pop up.
Yeah, I mean, with the tech workers specifically, like, I mean, tech workers are well paid, right? They live comfortable lives generally for now. As tech work becomes more common, as kids start getting trained to code in school, as code boot camps become a lot more easy to attend, a lot cheaper. And as companies outsource a lot of their development labor, I think a lot of tech workers are starting to see a future in which being a software developer, for example, becomes a low wage white collar job, essentially. But at the same time, they're also, at least with a lot of the tech workers I talk to, are starting to realize what their actual power is. Right. So at the end of the day, tech workers, for example, just like how Uber drivers make Uber all their money on their own vehicles, right, and take all the risk so Uber can make a profit, to the point where Uber just would go bankrupt almost immediately if the drivers all just refused to work for even a day or two. Tech workers have this remarkable amount of power in that all of the code that runs Facebook, all of the code that runs Palantir surveillance systems, all of the code that runs, you know, X key score for the NSA, all the code that runs Google, all the code that more or less organizes our work schedules and our lives, determines when we get our tax returns, all these things. All that code is written by tech workers, right? Lowly tech workers, no one will ever hear their names, who, you know, grind away writing code all day for a relatively solid wage. And what it looks like to me in some of these areas, like precarious freelance labor or in the tech industry, is that organizing isn't even so much, as you said, about wages, right? Although there's an element of that, especially in lower wage freelance labor, but it's also about the ability to immediately impact things that are being done by the people that pay those wages, right? So just like you see workers at Amazon starting to reveal details about facial recognition technology, and you see workers at Google threatening to strike over Google technology being used for surveillance. There's a lot of other workers that work in other places that are doing somewhat shady stuff that if they ever realize their power and decide to get some ethics, could make a real go at actually shutting a lot of this stuff down. That'd be much more effective than we'd ever be able to be from the outside.
This has been a great tangent we've got off on. I know we really wanted to talk about border policy too, so I feel like we should probably switch to that. Again, I think it is important to continue to have these discussions. I think whether it's like syndicalism or like the post left or whatever, like just become these boogeymans that like we kind of like to like, you know, beat up and reaffirm like a position against, you know, like stupid, you know, like armchair idiot asshole. And then the other one's like, you know, stuck in the past moron with the red card. I mean, like, it's like we end up kind of like talking past each other. It's yep. like, and we also don't have to all do the same thing. You know, it's like, I think it's great that people like are really good at different stuff and really good at different kinds of organizing. And, yep. you know, workplace organizing is hard because it's like, if you're organizing there and you're really putting in a lot of work, like you still got to go there in the morning. And if people know you're a crazy anarchist trying to like do all this stuff at your workplace, you know, they know where you work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they know everything about you.
Yeah, so what's important is that in these discussions where everyone devolves into hyperbolic name calling, we all need to essentially have a little bit of humility here and realize that none of us know what to do. Right. Like none of us know the magic, you know, spell or mixture of whatever to make things fundamentally different. We don't. If we did, we'd be there already, right? None of us know this answer, that this is all a series of experiments that we're all undertaking for different reasons. We're thinking about them different ways. And that's important to respect, right? We all need to understand that we could all be wrong about all of this, let alone be wrong about whatever, you know, nuanced sect of anarchism we decide to affiliate ourselves with.
Exactly. Well, one thing no one can go wrong with is to go on to itsgoingdown.org/shop and become a monthly supporter. Just kidding. No, you should really do that though. But let's dive into this talk about you know, the border. And I know that you've this week that you've been looking into it. You know, we were talking this week about kind of like what we wanted to discuss tonight, and I feel like so much of, you know, the stuff around the border is just really getting swept under the rug, because yeah. All we basically hear is that Trump wants this concrete or, you know, like beamed wall of some sort. And then we hear this kind of other voice, which is like, well, yeah, we don't want a wall, but we want, you know, security or border safety. And like, what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. And what does that actually mean for like human beings, for people on the ground? What does this actually translate to in terms of policy?
Yeah. So the mantra we've heard for the last 4 weeks has been, everybody agrees on border security, but we're really trying to decide is how, and that Democrats don't want a wall and Trump wants a wall. Right. But really the discussion goes much deeper than that. And it's one that's actually grounded more in military theory than anything else. That when we think about the border, we're not just thinking about a line in the sand in the southern United States. The border is everywhere at this point, right? We've all lived through an era of mass migration. We've all lived in an era in which ICE now operates essentially everywhere, right? In which the Border Patrol can operate within, I think it's like 75 miles of any border, which a lot of people live within 75 miles of a border. That we live in an era in which increasingly everybody's being tracked. Employment records being tracked. We have citizenship checks when people start trying to get jobs, to the point where companies are trying to forge records. The impact of the border on our everyday life has been profound. But the ways that that's happened and the mentalities that that's been driven by can really be drawn back to discussions that started after the war in Vietnam. So after the war in Vietnam, where the United States got trounced by the Viet Cong and had to leave Vietnam in 1975. A lot of the people that came out of the Vietnam War were people that we later would hear about. Colin Powell is one of them, right? And around Colin Powell, there was a study group that built up in the U.S. military with the goal of trying to determine how to prevent the war in Vietnam from ever happening ever again. And their decision, what they kind of, the conclusion that they came to was that the way to do this was through frontal confrontation and overwhelming force. A good example of that is the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, where there were days of airstrikes. Those airstrikes targeted radar stations, command and control, communications, water purification, pretty much all the infrastructure that would support everyday life within Iraq. And Iraqis are still dealing with the fallout from that bombing campaign. We saw another example of that in Serbia. And the goal of those sorts of campaigns is to overwhelm the oppositional force, whatever that happens to be, and to minimize casualties on the American side by doing that. That morphed into a concept within the U.S. military, that overwhelming force and sort of the image or the aesthetics of overwhelming force are always an inherent good. And that's in a lot of ways where Trumpian border policy and Republican border policy at large is really coming from. It's this idea that in Trump's world and in the Republican world, if we assume that migrants are the enemy, right, which is essentially what they're doing, then what we have to do is we have to both construct the apparatus of overwhelming force and use that as a deterrent for people to come here. right? And this isn't just a Trump policy. These policies have been in place slowly. They've been put in place slowly but surely since the Reagan administration, where Reagan ended a lot of the guest worker programs that had been in place and had instituted, you know, mass border security. That amplified pretty dramatically after September 11th with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and the insertion of the Border Patrol inside of that. The Democrats are making this argument that they don't want the wall, that they want, quote, other things, like other security things. But what does that mean, right? So if we go back to the Clinton administration, and then in a much more contemporary way, the Obama administration, the Democrat plan for the border has always been not necessarily to police the border less or to militarize the border less or to make the border any less of a war zone, but it's been about doing it differently, right? So what they're proposing essentially is that we turn the border into a mass surveillance zone with cameras and motion sensors and infrared cameras and helicopters and, you know, mobile response forces and things like this. And the goal of that is to essentially construct the dynamics of area denial, right? So the idea that a person can't enter an area purely through the potential that one's going to get caught by a device that they can't see. And that uncertainty is actually what, as the Democrats are claiming, is a much more effective strategy than frontal force. So let's think about for a second our cities, any of us that live in cities, right? In the past, and even in some cities now, say take Chicago, for example, there's a tendency of the police department to respond with overwhelming force to anything, right? And that's part of a strategy of constructing fear and constructing deterrence through overwhelming force. But if you look at a city like New York, for example, or London, right, you will still see police in a place like New York, and you'll see police in a place like London. But what you'll see a lot more of are cameras, easy pass readers at the intersections, tracking people's motion, like movements through the city, license plate readers, and they're all very public about what those things are. It's not a secret that in New York City, they have command centers where they can see the feeds from thousands of different cameras. So what does that do? So if you're a person and you're thinking of engaging in activity that the state doesn't approve of, essentially, it's much easier to see the police car coming than it is to see every single corner of every single building to decide whether a camera's there or not. And so what we're really watching here is we're watching the Democrats take lessons from what they consider to be the sort of formative lessons they should have taken from the war in Iraq, right? So this mentality of using surveillance as a deterrent and using surveillance as a form of area denial is something which actually comes from the troop surge in Iraq when David Petraeus was put in command in Iraq. And they sent thousands of troops, I think it was something like 50,000 troops, to Iraq to sort of overwhelm the Iraqi insurgency. But the way that they did that is they did that through irregular patrolling. So they would patrol around towns, but they wouldn't do it all at the same time, always at the same time every day. They would stagger the patrol pattern. So you never really knew when American troops were going to be in proximity. And what that does is it creates uncertainty. They put surveillance cameras everywhere. And what does that do? It creates uncertainty. When they arrested people, they would take all of their biometric data. They take your fingerprints, of course. They'd also take a retinal scan. And they take a DNA sample. And that's a tactic that they've ported over to Afghanistan now. That's also a tactic that some governments are starting to use. I just heard through the grapevine that the Jamaican government now is demanding that every single person on the island undergo retinal scans in order to get a driver's license.
Jesus.
So it's kind of mass collection of biometric data isn't necessarily meant to create correlations in the system if something were to occur that the state would be interested in. It's merely to create the idea that that could happen. Right. So there was an article written in Insurgencies, I think volume one, I forget which, but it was actually about the sort of irony of the Edward Snowden leaks. Right. So the NSA, for example, is an organization which existed in total secrecy ever since its founding. no one really knew in any specific detail what the NSA actually did, except that there was this vague idea that they did signals intelligence and also cryptography. But there really wasn't much of an idea of what that looked like. And what that meant was that the NSA could function very effectively as an intelligence gathering operation. No one could take countermeasures against something that they didn't understand was happening, right? So they were able to gather information through secrecy. But one of the things that's actually happened since the Snowden leaks have occurred is that the NSA's very existence has become a sort of strange deterrent that a lot of people who would otherwise, you know, be careful online and use the internet in responsible ways and not leak their personal data everywhere, a lot of those people have either fallen into privacy fatigue, where they're just tired and don't care anymore, or they've just stopped using large elements of the internet. They've cut themselves off. They've stopped communicating with people. That actually the revealing of information about the NSA, I'm not saying that revealing the information was a bad thing, but one of the unintended consequences of that is that the NSA now is an incredibly effective deterrent for anybody being able to communicate openly, which is a very different role than it played before. But it's not a deterrent because they're actually listening to everything that you say or reading all of your emails. It's a deterrent because they could, not because they are. And so, you know, I mean, the term panopticism, or to talk about, you know, the sort of panopticon or panoptic effects, is trite and banal, but there's a reality to that, right? That if the U.S. government, for example, announces that they're putting up a bunch of cameras in the desert to monitor everyone that's coming over the border, and then puts up dummy cameras, it would essentially have the same effect as if the cameras were real. And that seems to be the Democrats' plan. So Democrats have this strange idea that surveillance is impartial, right? And you'll see this in cities around the country that instituted things like traffic camera programs, which would take pictures of people running red lights. That the argument in city after city after city was that, well, if the police are going to be racist, cameras can't be racist, so we should just put cameras everywhere. That was the argument. And in at least a few cities, those very same programs have been shot down through referendum.
But, you know, what's funny about that, you know, Phoenix, Arizona is another good example. They used to have those speed cameras that actually looks like a little guy, a little person, little speed person. Speed person with there's a tall beam, and then there's like a head, and then it has like a little arm that's like a little gun. And they put them on the freeways, and the idea was that, let's say you drove over 85 miles per hour, it would take your photo automatically. Mm-hmm. And then you would get sent a ticket in the mail. Mm-hmm. And people, this was like 10, 15 years ago, people were so pissed off about these things. They were literally, there was one instance where somebody shot up one of the electrical boxes that controlled this thing, and unfortunately there was a worker inside and killed that person. Mm-hmm. But people were destroying these things, shooting them. Yep. There was actually a funny viral video that even made it all the way to, it's still on InfoWars if you want to go watch it, but anarchists literally dressed up as Santa. This is in the Phoenix area. And they went and they put, this was during Christmas time, and they went and they put these big present boxes and like bow ties, and it was like, and they called it Santa's Against the Surveillance State. And actually the video is really cool, is because it makes a connection between the policing of movement and surveillance at the border. Yeah. And with the speed cameras, and they were basically, their point was, is that, you know, whiteness is the line that basically separates us from saying like, it's messed up when it happens here, but it's okay when it happens there. Yeah. And basically, long story short, people were actually able to, you know, push out the speed cameras. And, you know, I remember people, anarchists were writing about the speed cameras at that time. And one of the other things that they were saying was that cities were also basing their city budget on the money coming in from the ticketing. So essentially what it was is that it was, you know, a form of a poll tax.
Yeah.
And like what you were saying is very true, is that, you know,
liberals are saying, well, at least, you know, these can't be racist.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, that's really true. There's a really fabulous video I actually really encourage people to watch from Vice. It's called Driving While Black.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, I think it's in St. Louis, and it's about an African-American journalist that goes undercover with, you know, a local activist. And they literally just drive around, I think it's St. Louis or something like that, some neighborhood, and they get pulled over like five times.
Yep.
And the point that they make is that it's not necessarily that they just that they got pulled over. Mm-hmm. It's that when they get pulled over, they have to go to court for fix-it tickets, for different, you know, little infractions, you know, whatever. And that in doing so, when they go to court, they have to pay a minimal court fee. So even if they go to court and it gets, you know, the cop isn't there, it gets let go, you know, whatever, it's $5, you know, you fixed your headlight, congratulations, you can go home. They still have to pay that small court fee. So obviously all these court fees add up. And essentially what their argument is that this is essentially a poll tax on the black community.
Yeah.
Just for the crime of being black. And that, you know, this isn't happening in other neighborhoods. And it's interesting as well, because if you, again, if you go back to, like, you know, the classic line of whiteness, we know, what are we upset about? You know, no taxation without representation.
Mm-hmm.
But again, here you have a community that is essentially being taxed for the crime of the color of their skin and being a poor working class community.
Yeah.
And they're just repeatedly getting taxed through the through tickets for no reason whatsoever.
Well, and this is a point that there's an organization in New York City called Crypto Harlem, which is amazing. And anyone that's interested in cryptography, privacy, security stuff should definitely check out what Crypto Harlem is doing, because they do really amazing work and they've been doing it for a really long time. But one of the reasons that they exist is that their goal is to train people in marginalized, highly surveilled communities how to essentially circumvent surveillance. So they specifically are active in Harlem, where there is still a large population of people of color who are significantly less wealthy than the white yuppies moving into the area that exist under heavy levels of surveillance. And if you go around any city in the country, you will see surveillance cameras concentrated in areas that are primarily populated by people of color and poor folks. And the border is no different. Right. If we look at the border, what's happening in these circumstances is that the camera itself is a neutral technological apparatus. The placement of the camera, however, functions completely around social dynamics, one of which very prominent within those is racism and the history of American racism. Why are they only talking about putting these cameras, heat sensors, motion sensors, things like this on the southern border, not the northern one, for example? Right. So we're watching the same dynamics that have turned our cities into fortresses under Democrats. Right. Because mind you, most major cities in the United States are governed by Democrats. These cities have become fortresses, essentially. And what we're doing is we're watching that same dynamic of fortification also start to function around the border, with a slightly modified understanding of what fortification means. So fortification now is no longer about building one giant wall. It's actually about turning this sort of terrain of surveillance into everything, to where everything is capable of being monitored, metriced, watched, right? Potentially. And the potentially is the operative term here, because it's not an actually, or at least we can't determine whether it is an actually. We don't know if someone's watching that footage right now. We don't know if that camera is actually recording. We don't know if that camera is actually real. We have no idea. But what's fundamentally important about that is that we have to live as if they are. Because, and this goes back to something else Edward Snowden said, which I think is fundamentally important for understanding this conversation. One of the things he said was, the question about surveillance is not the question of whether or not we're doing anything wrong, right? So many people want to discuss this on the level of whether we're doing something wrong. It's not a question of whether we're doing something wrong. Instead, it becomes a question of us losing autonomy over being able to decide for ourselves whether our actions are right or wrong. That at the point where somebody else is able to view our lives from distance, they all of a sudden get to fall into the position of the arbiter of our actions. They get to determine whether our actions are good or bad, whether they're suspect or not. We lose that autonomy completely. And so at the point in which surveillance becomes the sort of operative strategy, as the Democrats are proposing, not only are we going to be increasing the level of surveillance domestically within the United States, but we're going to be fundamentally stripping the migrants themselves of autonomy over the ability to be the arbiter of their own actions. Right? We're going to be stealing that from them. We're going to be making that decision for them at some sort of border patrol office where they may or may not watch these things. We're also going to turn the border into essentially a military zone where drones and helicopters start hovering around all the time looking for people with heat sensing infrared cameras. Right?
Which, and again, I mean, you know, as we've said on this show before, like, about the wall, like, all the reasons why you wouldn't want to build the wall or all the reasons why it'd be stupid to militarize the border. Not only would it be a waste of our tax money, you know, it's going to lead to a lot of people dying and a lot of just broke people that are trying to literally cross a line in the sand to get a job somewhere, you know, to go through a lot of misery. And also, too, the other thing is that, look, if you cross into the United States, you get caught. Where are you sent to? You're sent to an immigrant detention facility. These are private institutions that make money. A lot of these companies especially are the same companies which donated millions of dollars to Donald Trump's campaign and are doing very well financially under his regime because they banked on the fact that he was going to put a lot of migrant people, undocumented people in private detention facilities. And that's exactly what's happening. But not only that, but if you get in there, just like if you go to jail, you can bail out of those places. So you can, if you get caught up and you get sent to a detention facility, they'd be like, well, you can leave, but you got to pay us $1,000 and then we can let you out. And then you come to your, you know, cause the only reason you're in, this is the whole, you know, this is the whole reason people were talking about abolishing ICE is that the whole reason that you're in this detention facility is because you're waiting to go to your immigration court hearing. But you can bond out of these places and then go back, of course, and then go to your court hearing later, and you can get your stuff together and talk to a lawyer and not have to be in this disgusting hellhole. Yeah. But, of course, that's making lots of money for these companies, and it's, you know, it's disgusting.
Well, and so then, I mean, the question is, like, why talk about the nuances of border policy? Well, partially because I think it's important for us to understand the implications of what's going to happen. But most importantly, there's been this tendency, I think, amongst, you know, the left, people in the post-left even, right, to fall into this kind of reactionary position when it has to do with things that deal with Donald Trump, right? See, such a reprehensible character. It's super easy to knee-jerk reject everything that he's saying, and tacitly, if not overtly, at least be somewhat happy if his opponents win something, right? And I've seen this play itself out on Twitter, right? You can even see it in blog posts from, you know, so-called radicals that keep talking about, you know, well, you know, it's not everything we want, but the wall is like a giant symbol of racism, so the wall's bad, right? And that's true. But what we can't do is let the critique of the wall become tacit support for the Democrats. That there is fundamental agreement between the two on 2 points. The first is that the border absolutely needs to become essentially a military zone, and that military zone needs to be able to have tentacles that stretch out throughout the entirety of the domestic space. That is definitely a point of agreement. The other point of agreement is that the border is what constructs American identity. That it's the ability, national identity is not just constructed purely through positive identification, but it's also inherently structured through exclusion. Right, the ability of us to be able to say that certain people need to have certain paperwork to come over the border is the very thing that constructs the legalistic construct of the border. And without that, the very ability of state sovereignty to function collapses entirely, right, into something else, right, not necessarily inherently better for whatever that means, but into something else. And so what we're really looking at is we're looking at a government shutdown which is impacting the lives of millions and millions of people in incredibly negative ways, all over essentially nuances of border militarization, right? They're debating the strategy of border militarization, not whether or not border militarization should function or whether the border should be there at all. They're really debating at what form do we build an incredibly repressive apparatus to maintain the functionality of the border. That's what's really at stake here. And if people aren't outraged about that, I don't know what's really going to get them up in arms. It's infuriating.
I mean, I really encourage people go back and listen to the last This Is America podcast. I mean, the conversation with the volunteer of No More Deaths is really heartbreaking. I mean, literally the border patrols. I mean, I hate to laugh, but it's sickeningly, you know, laughable. But basically, the border patrol and the fish and game, like wildlife fish and game, who I think is in control of this area. Like, No More Deaths is accused of dropping off water and food literally on American soil. This is public land. Their crime is going onto the U.S. side of the border and leaving water and food for people who, since like 2000, like 3,000 people have died out in this area. Yeah. Maybe it's not that much. Maybe it's just a lower than that, but a couple thousand. And what the Border Patrol says is that they shouldn't do that. That's illegal because, one, they're damaging the environment.
Yeah.
So they're using this like woke language, like, no, bro, you're damaging the environment, man. And then, two, they say what the migrants should do instead is that they have these towers, and you're supposed to click on the towers, and you're so, you know, I'm stuck in the desert, I need help. And then the land management people are supposed to come out and get you. And then, of course, they're going to throw you in an immigrant detention facility. But the No More Deaths person was saying, you know, out of 1,000 attempts by people, they've only had 2 responses.
Yep.
Which is insane.
Yep.
So basically they're saying, like, you can't put this water here because it's going to impact. Literally, this area used to be a disaster. Like, they used to explode bombs and like army stuff out there. So you can't this land that we just spent like decades fucking up, we don't want you to put a bottle of water there. And these are the same people that come by and literally slash this shit and then throw the trash on the ground. Remember when No More Deaths put out that report where the fucking Border Patrol is just walking by and they literally just kick these bottles of water so hard that the caps fall off, and then they just tumble. It's disgusting. And then they want to turn around and say, like, you're damaging the environment. It's like, you're the same motherfuckers that just left the trash in the fucking desert.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think another point that No More Deaths people consistently make and have been making for years, which I think is entirely salient and something that we need to be very aware of, is that what they're doing is, to the degree that No More Deaths is effective, they're mitigating to some degree the deterrent effect of border militarization, at least in a certain area of the border region. And what that's doing is it is allowing people to cross, right, or to feel safer crossing. The fact that the Border Patrol is willing to let people die in the desert rather than allow them to get water isn't even so much about the Border Patrol caring about how many people they kill indirectly. It's about the Border Patrol recognizing that survival lessens the deterrent effect, and that if they can lower the survival rates, that it's less likely that people are going to cross. And so what's amazing about that is that at the end of the day, we're existing in a reality in which preventing people from crossing the border is considered such an inherent good that they're willing to let people die over it. And that's an incredibly disturbing reality. All of that to uphold nothing except the very idea of national identity, right? So there are these intensely personal stories about the border, which are incredibly important for people to listen to. But there's also these fundamental, these sort of fundamental structures that exist because of the border that really form the very foundations of the state itself. And it's something that we need to be analyzing on both levels all the time to really understand what's going on and why. Otherwise, it seems entirely nonsensical. And when it's nonsensical, it's unable to be fought effectively.
And again, I mean, I hate to bring it back to, our buddy Bannon,
yeah.
But, you know, remember when he took the stage at CPAC, you know, his 3-point plan for revolution was, you know, economic nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And also, economic nationalism. And also, you know, I don't remember the term he used, but it basically like border sovereignty. It was like creating a national identity out of, you know, securing our borders. Yeah. And the third one was, you know, the destruction of the administrative state, which of course, you know, we're seeing playing out in grand detail right now.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
And, you know, again, like we can see where these two things link up. And, you know, I almost wonder, like, would a wall maybe even be better? Like, would it be better for them just to, like, waste, like, 20 years, like, piddling around in the desert, like, building a shitty wall than, like, some, like, robocopian dystopian, like, militarization with drones? And, I mean, they already have all that stuff, but...
Yeah, and generally when when things like state policy are being discussed, better isn't an operative category, right? The entire base reality that allows this discussion to even be possible is based in existential subjugation, right? It would be folly for them to build a giant concrete symbol to American racism in the desert, especially because people can just dig holes under it. But the very idea of border militarization is outside of debate. And I think the reality is that very clearly the border wall is not going to actually function the way that people think it will. There's been so much mythology built up around the idea of the border wall at this point that it's become almost deified, a sort of hopeless potential dream for the future or something. But I don't think anyone should be fooled that the second that the border wall, if it were to be built, fails catastrophically as it will, they'll just revert back to using more panoptic means. It's what's available. It's what technology exists and what sort of what I would consider to be legitimate or, you know, within the military, legitimate military thinkers are saying is that concentrating a bunch of force at one point makes no sense. What you really need to do is spread this stuff out and create deterrent effect. That's essentially at this point U.S. military doctrine. So if the border wall were to fail, they'll just fall back into that anyways. It's the entire trajectory of both military affairs and law enforcement at this point.
And again, you know, another thing to harp on is that, you know, we all kind of laughed when Trump brought the troops out to the border and then like they all went back, or some of them went back, but the Pentagon basically spent more money and sent more troops along the border and stretched them out. So I mean,
yep,
they, you know, that kind of thing that we all were kind of laughing at originally, I mean, that's the new normal now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, the Democrats always, whether this is an overseas military strategy or domestic policy, always have this idea that if you can use cameras and drones and deterrence and surveillance, you don't need to put a lot of troops in a place. You can just deploy them where they need to be when they need to be there. I think a lot of people need to go back and read the – it was a document released by the U.S. military in 2010. And it's the – what's it called? U.S. Military Strategic Doctrine document. They released them roughly over 10 years. But this was released under the Obama administration, and essentially what they're doing is they're outlining the exact same strategy that Democrats are proposing for the border, that, as they say, the era of large force footprint operations are over. There should be no more occupations, that essentially their goal is to project U.S. military force globally through, you know, surveillance drones, airstrikes, and special operations missions, right, to do targeted strikes against individual people that the U.S. military has deemed able to be killed, essentially. And they've laid this whole strategy out. Ever since that document was written, the Democratic Party itself and also their kind of attendant think tanks have really, really pushed this vision of diffuse force with surveillance-heavy strategy. And it's the same thing that they're pushing at the border. No one should be fooled. I mean, this is a strategy. The Democrats are literally trying to impose a strategy for the border that comes from the occupation of Iraq. It is a military strategy based in the attempt to try and reinforce U.S. global hegemony without having to maintain a military of 5 to 10 million. And that's exactly what they're essentially trying to put forward for the border now. Nancy Pelosi has alluded to this when she says, well, we don't need a border wall. We just need cameras and motion sensors and infrared cameras everywhere. Well, this is,
and again, I mean, they still have, you know, they still know that they're going to depend on migrant labor.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, nothing's going to change. I mean, it's just sick, you know, and again, like this, we're literally talking about the mechanization of thousands of people filling detention facilities, dying in the desert, living as second class citizens in the shadows, always afraid of ICE knocking on their door.
Or they're just pulling them over, depending on where you're right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as a person who lives in an area where there's you know, a not insignificant amount of undocumented people, and in which there have been, you know, not in the immediate area, but outside of this immediate area, large ICE raids recently, it is absolutely terrifying for people. Anyone that's ever lived even mildly on the margins, right? Or sort of refuse to live sort of acceptable life for even a short period of time, can know a fraction of this, but I think it's almost impossible for most of us to imagine living your everyday life that way all the time, constantly in fear of a cop looking at you the wrong way and trying to check your papers, right? It's horrifying. And it's the kind of thing that if you really look at critiques of authoritarian regimes, are part of what gets critiqued is this sort of constant policing of everyday life, right? But as we go forward, this is exactly what we're seeing. And that's not being driven by Republican law and order politics. It's being driven by democratic mentalities of community policing and counterinsurgency.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.